So over the summer, the government has announced a series of position papers on various specific issues around Brexit. The other thing that's happened is that Theresa May has gone from being Theresa the Conqueror, the all-powerful, to Theresa May, she could be gone any minute. So she has to recast her Brexit vision in the light of the fact that the public actually, slightly to everyone's surprise, doesn't seem that enamored of her previous Brexit vision.
An upstart ride-sharing app called Taxify is already challenging Uber's territory in 19 countries across Europe, the Middle East, and Africa. But with a London launch this week, it's entering a crowded battlefield where it will not only have to deal with Uber's colossus, but other apps, traditional cab services, and a government that's swung the regulatory hammer hard in recent years against perceived uncompetitive practices.
According to the local reports, as you mentioned, it seems, according to spy agencies here in South Korea, that they actually have been moving, the Pyongyang has been moving this ICBM starting last night. So just a day after they conducted this nuclear test on Sunday, and high likelihood, according to the intelligence officials here, that they could be firing this before Saturday, which is the founding day of North Korea.
WGN Radio's daily conversation about the life of business and the business of life. This is The Opening Bell with Steve Grzanich on 720 WGN.
Good morning, everyone. Welcome to the program. Today is Tuesday. It's September 5th, 2017, 5:10 in the morning. Glad you're here with us for another edition of The Opening Bell, another business day, and for a lot of us, another business week getting going. Hopefully you had a really nice, safe, relaxing Labor Day weekend, but time to get back at it. Now, lots to cover in the show this morning. A little bit later on, we'll be talking about the GMO controversy, and a new study from Purdue University is out about just what people, consumers, feel about this, their consumer acceptance of GMOs. We'll talk to a Purdue Ag Econ professor who has done a little study on this. In a little bit, we'll talk about the psychology of getting back to school and having a successful school year. But first, on the WGN Associated Bank Market Desk this morning, we're looking at futures in negative territory this morning for the Dow, off about 49 points. NASDAQ and S&P futures are lower as well. Asian shares generally lower as well, with the Nikkei off about 122, Hang Seng off about a point. The Shanghai is off about 5. In Europe this morning, markets are generally higher. The FTSE is up about 8. The DAX is up about 93. The CAC in France is up about 10, which is good for about a quarter. Some stories that we're watching for you this morning. In Britain, London, you heard there in the opening montage, the chief Brexit negotiator will face questions from lawmakers returning from summer recess. Starting today, the government plans to intensify talks with the European Union. David Davis is set to make a statement to the House of Commons as Prime Minister. Theresa May braces for her first test of the new term. Lawmakers this week will begin debating the government's Brexit repeal bill, which will effectively transfer EU law to UK statute books on the day Britain leaves the European Union. A couple of other stories we're watching for you as well. Hyundai Corporation and said its China plant has halted operation due to a supply disruption. It is the second shutdown in China in less than a month, as diplomatic tensions between China and South Korea over that U.S. missile defense system take its toll on business. Yesterday, Labor Day, a holiday to honor American workers, had a lot of people out on the streets with marches across the country. Gatherings and parades invited politicians to march and speak on the day that also marks a final hurrah for summer. In downtown Los Angeles, hundreds of people marched calling for a $15 an hour minimum wage. Similar marches were held in Chicago and elsewhere. And gas prices have started to steady out after the hurricane and tropical storm Harvey. They hit a high for the Labor Day weekend, but have started to go down in some parts of the country. As of this morning, national average gallon of gasoline is $2.63 a gallon. Well, today's the first day of school for Chicago public school students. Many suburban schools are already back at it. And there's a psychology of getting back to the classroom that really could affect outcomes, academic outcomes. Julia Ogg is Associate Professor of Psychology at Northern Illinois University, and she is with us this morning. Good morning, Julia. Welcome to The Opening Bell.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
Good to have you with us, because this is obviously a big day for a lot of kids going back in Chicago. A lot of other kids are already back, too. But tell us about this idea that your emotional status can affect your progress in school.
Yeah, sure. So we know that there's always been a focus on academics in school, but more recently we've been paying more attention to kids' social-emotional development in school. So this would be things like your ability to recognize and manage your emotions, your ability to set and work towards goals, your ability to understand other people's perspectives, to build your relationships with other people, and also your ability to make good decisions and problem-solve difficulties. So you can imagine these things would fit really well with your academic skills in terms of kind of helping you work through difficulties and managing your emotions when you're, you know, at school and you're wondering, gosh, who should I sit with? Or do you think my teacher will be nice? Or will the other kids be nice to me? Or how do I react when they're not?
Yeah, and is this something that affects children differently at different ages? I would imagine what is happening for kids in first or second grade is different from kids that are going back to high school today.
Yeah, absolutely. So these skills do develop over time, but I think a lot of the basic ideas between them would be different. So for younger kids, it's really they're starting to be able to, you know, when they start kindergarten, they can recognize some simple emotions, but they might need a little more support in being able to recognize and distinguish when they're, say, disappointed versus frustrated. But as kids get older, the kind of the same skills are important, but it might be that they're trying to use all the skills that they have to make good decisions when they're faced with really challenging academic work or, you know, peer pressure to engage in risky behaviors.
It's interesting because just reading some of the research on this, this goes beyond getting good grades in school, doesn't it? It goes even after you leave school to what kind of job you get, how much money you might make in that job. So it lasts a lifetime, doesn't it?
Absolutely. So there's, you know, short-term consequences like I'm talking about, but there's also some really long-term outcomes of social-emotional learning. So that would be, yeah, your ability, kids' ability to graduate from high school. People have found that your social-emotional skills when you start school are actually predictive of your likelihood of graduating from high school and college, how likely you are to have a stable career. One study found that your social-emotional skills were actually four times more important to predict your professional success than your IQ. So yes, these are really important skills that kids need to learn.
Julia, hang on with us. We're going to continue our conversation with Julia Ogg. She is an associate professor of psychology at Northern Illinois University. And when we come back, we'll get into more of this a little bit more detailed and maybe offer you a little bit of information about how you can promote social emotional learning in your children or the children you interact with.
You're listening to The Opening Bell on 720 WGN.
Good morning. Welcome back to the program. We're on this morning with Julia Ogg, who is a professor, associate professor of psychology at Northern Illinois University, helping get our kids emotionally ready, socially, emotionally ready for school to help improve their academic status. Julie, before the break, we were talking a little bit about social, emotional skills. Before we go through some of the tips about how we can help kids get there, remind us again what some of those skills are.
Sure. So these are the ability to recognize and manage your emotions. This would be the ability to take other people's perspectives, your ability to kind of read other people and also to be able to build relationships with people. And then also kind of the last component I often talk about is the ability to make good decisions and problem solve challenges that you're faced with, whether they're personal or interpersonal challenges.
So how can we as adults or parents help our kids get down this road?
Good. So I think there's a couple of really specific strategies we can use. One is just to be a good emotion role model ourselves. If you think about when your kids are little and they fall down, they look at you to kind of see how you're going to respond. And if you make a big deal, oh my goodness, are you okay? They tend to react that way. Also, in contrast, if you say, oh, you know, you're okay, just brush it off, they tend to kind of respond similarly. And that goes with the more complex emotions of kids develop too. They look to you. And they also wonder about your emotions. And so if you don't share those with them very often, they might kind of not be able to learn from you in that way. So, you know, doing things like saying, you know, I get nervous when I meet new people, but some of the things that I do when I'm nervous is I think they're probably nervous too, or this could be a really good new friend. So just remembering that sometimes you might have to sort of be explicit about the emotions you're feeling, and your kids can learn from that and learn ways to deal with their emotions. I would say a second really good strategy to use is to be your kid's emotion coach. So when they're little, as we mentioned before, they might not be able to really label their emotions. And so you being able to say, oh, you know, it seems like that made you really mad. Let's talk about, let's process that, and let's problem solve that. And so one great strategy here is to give your kids some really specific strategies they can use. So if you think about the coaching analogy, you might teach your kids all their basketball skills, but if they're really struggling with their free throws, you're going to spend more time practicing that. So if your kid has a lot of difficulty when they get frustrated, they get really mad and they just shut down, or they're having difficulties when they get teased by a particular person, work on specific strategies for those situations. So a good one for kids who get frustrated would be something like, you know, when I get mad, I'm going to count to 10, or I'm going to walk away. And those very specific, easy to remember strategies can help your kids navigate that. When their emotions are high and they can't, you know, make a lot of good decisions, if they have that simple go-to strategy, that's really, really helpful. And it's also helpful because they're learning that we can't always, you know, manage how we're going to feel in a situation, but we can manage how we respond to that situation. And so that's where that emotion coaching can help. A third strategy I would recommend is, it's kind of a simple strategy, but just giving your kids opportunities to practice these skills is really an important part. So kids who have the opportunity to negotiate, you know, age-appropriate conflict with their peers, or who are able to do some of their own problem solving without having their parents completely hovering over, or some kids might even just avoid these situations. Kids who have opportunities to practice those sort of little situations tend to do better when bigger situations come about. So when they need to make good decisions with their peers, or when they need to figure out how to do well academically in college. So sometimes as a parent, it can, you know, be comforting to try to help solve your kids' problems, and to a certain level, you do need to support them in doing that, but solving it for them doesn't sort of help things in the long run, because they need to develop those skills themselves.
No, I was just going to interject something here, because we send our kids off to school, and we teachers have so much on their plates already. How do we know that our kids are getting this sort of how do we know how well they're doing on this in school? Or is this something that we need to monitor very closely?
Great question. So there is a lot more focus in schools on social emotional learning. Actually, in Illinois, we have social emotional learning standards that go right alongside our academic learning standards. So schools are focused on this and working on this as well. So a great way is to connect with your school. They might be collecting data already on all the kids to see how they're doing, so you could maybe find some of that out. The other reason to connect with the school is if they have specific language that they're using, especially for younger kids. Maybe they have characters who, you know, help you manage your frustrations. If you can kind of generalize that and use that at home too, that can really help kids learn it well. So I would say just talking to your kid's teacher in the school can help you find out more information, but also help you reinforce what they're working on at school too.
And then when it comes time to make corrections here, there's a strategy that you've described as positive discipline. What is that?
Yes. Well, I would say the best prevention, or the best discipline, would be to prevent issues. So the most you can, you know, set up strategies where you monitor and set your expectations so your kids really know what's expected of them. That's the best way to prevent. But once they do maybe engage in some misbehavior, which all kids do, it's really important in terms of their social emotional development to talk to them about it and to think about what help them walk through and think about what the consequences of their actions are on other people. That helps them develop empathy and the idea that when I do something, it doesn't always just affect me. It might hurt my family's relationship with school, or it might hurt a peer's feelings, or it might have these other consequences that maybe I wasn't thinking about. And so teaching them that and talking about that can really help them also develop their skills.
This is good information, Julia. Where can we find more if we want to read up on this on our own? Obviously, it sounds like a teamwork thing with schools, so I'm guessing parents will get information on that, but where can we go to find more?
Yeah. A really great website is the Collaborative for Academic, Social, and Emotional Learning. And you could just Google that, and they have a website that has all about social-emotional learning and a lot of the specifics of the definitions of social-emotional learning that is widely used, and strategies that you can use also. So that would be probably my first go-to that I'd recommend.
And you said Collaboration for Social-Emotional Learning?
Collaborative for Academic, Social, and Emotional Learning.
All right. Julia, very good of you to be with us this morning. Best of luck to all of our students going back to school, and hopefully we can check back with you as the school year goes along.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me.
All right, Julia Ogg, Associate Professor of Psychology at Northern Illinois University. Good luck, students.
Now, WGN Radio's Daily Conversation about the life of business and the business of life. This is The Opening Bell with Steve Grzanich on 720 WGN.
Good morning, everyone. Welcome back to the program. It's 5:40 on our Tuesday edition of The Opening Bell. Glad you're back with us after the holiday. Majority of Americans say they would be okay with the release of genetically modified mosquitoes to decrease the Zika virus threat, but fewer than half of them are okay with genetic modification of animals, crops, and produce. We thought we'd talk about this today with a researcher who's been studying this. Wally Tyner is a professor of agricultural economics at Purdue University, and he's with us this morning. Good morning, Wally. Thanks for being with us.
Good morning. My pleasure.
Let's talk a little bit about the results first of this research. The majority of Americans okay with Zika modification. What are we talking about in terms of numbers?
Well, it's about two-thirds of Americans favor any use of GMOs for medical or health reasons. In the Zika case, it was modification of a mosquito that meant that the offspring were sterile so that the mosquito that carried the virus couldn't multiply. So they're fine with that. But when it comes to things they eat, not so much.
The numbers less than half. Why is that? I mean, have you been able to figure this out?
Well, people are when it comes to something that likely is to benefit them from health in a health way, whether it's a new vaccine or whether it's the Zika case, yeah, they're okay with that. But when it comes to something they eat, they're not so sure. They're worried about the possibility of something. The science says GM products are fine. They're not substantially different from non-GMO products, but for whatever reason, and we don't know completely all the reasons, people are precautious and they'd rather not have to deal with them in something they eat.
It sounds like there's a disconnect here, though. If you're willing to put something in your mouth for medicine that's been genetically modified but not food, is that a disconnect? Am I right in saying that?
Yes, I think so, very much so. And the other thing that is a disconnect is that in other work we've done, we've shown that suppose the GMO technology went away tomorrow, what would happen? Our food prices would go up substantially. Greenhouse gas emissions would go up because GM technology helps reduce the carbon footprint of agriculture. So GM provides all these benefits, but consumers don't seem to be aware of those benefits, and they're just concerned about, might there be something that the scientists aren't aware of? And that's something we just don't understand.
Is there an answer to why these numbers came out like this in the demographics of who you studied? Is it that they're not getting enough education on this? Is it people who have more money, less money? What are the demographics of this?
Great question. Males tended to be much more supportive of GMO than females. And, you know, one possible link, and it's just a hypothesis, is that the females are the ones that are feeding the children, and they take every precaution possible, and so that's one possible thing. People that were young tended to be more supportive. People that were higher income and better educated tended to be more supportive of GMO. So in each one of those demographics, you can see that, you know, more education leads to better information. A higher income may do the same thing. So there are demographic drivers that help explain some of the difference, but not all of it.
I saw something in preparing for our interview this morning that says that we in the news media have something perhaps to do with this, that many of the stories, a majority of the stories about genetic modification, according to our independent research, were negative. Are we affecting this in our reporting of all of this?
Well, yeah, to some extent. There are organizations that are very active in press releases and distributing information to the media, many of them negative, many of them arguing about possible ill effects, and you carry what you get. I mean, you got the press release on this study, you carried it, but you also carry all these things that are less scientifically based, so the public may be confused.
Wally, where do you go from here with this information? I'm guessing this is a stepping stone to something else, but where is that?
Well, we're going to continue to try to delve into these issues that you raised about what it is that would help people have sort of a more objective view of these things. What is it a matter of getting more accurate and better information? Is it a matter of just things that we can't control, like education level, income level, gender? But we're going to try to delve deeper into the drivers and see if there's some kind of policy mechanism that could be put into place that would provide people with better information. We also want to get out the information that GM food is actually much less expensive than conventional food, and that it reduces greenhouse gases more than conventional food. I don't think people are aware of those two things.
The other thing, too, and you touched on this earlier, is this the reality that GM has to be part of the future of agriculture, the present and future, if we all want to continue eating into the future. Is that a fair assessment?
Yeah, I mean, it would take so much more land to grow the food that we eat if we didn't have GM technology. And so as population increases and our demand for more meat increases, we're going to need this GMO technology to feed the world. And if it goes away, then food prices rise, and it's not a pretty picture.
The other part of this, too, is just sort of getting people maybe to farms and having conversations with the ag community, people who are maybe not familiar with that. Do you think that would be part of the education here?
Yeah, I think so. I think people, the fact that it's a very good point. The locavore movement is really moving fast in the U.S., and right now, most of it is people, or a lot of it is people that are growing non-GMO. But if we had farmers at the farmers markets that were selling GMO products and explaining to people that there is no difference in terms of their health or the nutrition or whatever, in fact, they may be more nutritious because they're preserved better, maybe that personal touch would help.
What about those who say that this is not completely settled science yet? People who are concerned about it, and you mentioned this earlier, that maybe science hasn't done a complete job of studying GMO food and crops and produce. Is that accurate or no?
Well, my area is not GMO science. It's the analysis of the GMO. But I can tell you that the three government agencies that regulate GMO have all said, and this is the FDA, USDA, and EPA, they have all said there's no difference in terms of the health effects or the quality or anything like that. So they've all invested millions of dollars in studying these and in trying to determine are they or are they not safe, and all three of them say that they're safe and good to eat.
Yeah, I would bet that there are a lot of people out there listening who, if they're against GMOs, have probably been taking some sort of medication that's genetically modified.
Oh, that's right. And vaccines and medications, a number of them have been brought to us through GMO technology. In fact, some people feel, back to this perception thing, that if the first GMO technologies that were adopted were all health, then the food ones would have been accepted much more. It turns out that the food ones came first. There was a bit of a scare when they came out, and that scare still lingers in people's minds.
Wally, really good research here. We're going to link out to it. We appreciate you being on with us this morning here in the opening bell.
My pleasure.
Wally Tyner is a professor of agriculture economics at Purdue University. And again, we'll link out to his research on this about GMOs and acceptance, consumer acceptance of it, on our Twitter page this morning.
You're listening to The Opening Bell on 720 WGN.
Good morning. Welcome back to the program at 5:53 on the WGN Associated Bank Market Desk this morning. Dow futures are pointing toward opening losses on Wall Street, off about 65 points now. NASDAQ futures off about 14, and S&P futures are off about 8. Gold and silver are trading higher this morning. Crude oil at $47.96 a barrel. Let's get the latest now on commodities and agriculture. Good morning, Orion Samuelson.
Good morning, Steve. While things were relatively quiet on the U.S. front with the Labor Day holiday yesterday, trade negotiators from Canada, the United States, and Mexico presented more proposals for a renewed North American free trade agreement. Teams from the three countries kicked off a second round of talks in Mexico City and did not disclose any of the discussions, but it's the next step in renegotiating NAFTA. There is another trade agreement that is causing some concern to American producers. The agreement is the U.S.-Korea Free Trade Agreement, and the U.S. Grains Council strongly opposes withdrawal from that agreement as an action that would lead to immediate and sustained losses in sales to our third largest corn customer. South Korea, the largest importer of U.S. corn so far this year. Now, let's look ahead. Can we continue the beautiful weather that we've had for the past couple of weeks that brought us through the Half Century of Progress show, the Farm Progress show? Well, we'll find out, won't we? Because tomorrow the Sandwich Fair gets underway at Sandwich, Illinois, well over a century and a quarter old, one of my favorite county fairs. Tomorrow, Max Armstrong will be there at noon with the Back Pages, our band. I'll be there on Thursday with the band at noontime, and then I'll be judging the beef cook-off at the Sandwich Fair. That will be on Thursday afternoon. Come to the fair. It's a good one at Sandwich, and the few others that are remaining also are good stops on your summer calendar. I'm Orion Samuelson. Have a great day.
Thanks, Orion. Beef cook-off, you don't have to tell me twice. A couple of other stories we're watching for you this morning. United Technologies is acquiring Rockwell Collins for $22.75 billion in order to expand its aerospace capabilities. United Tech, which makes Otis elevators and Pratt & Whitney engines, says it's paying $140 per share in cash and stock for Rockwell Collins. Also this morning, actually announced yesterday, Tribune Publishing, the owner of the Chicago Tribune, announcing it has acquired the outstanding interest of the New York Daily News, which will be for about a dollar, less than a dollar. They're actually picking up the debt of the New York Daily News. The New York Daily News has about 25 million unique monthly visitors through nydailynews.com and has been New York City's hometown newspaper since 1919. The Tribune also owns the L.A. Times. This morning on the WGN Associated Bank Market Desk Outlook, a couple of things happening in the world today. First, the Commerce Department releases factory orders for July. The House and Senate return to work after the Labor Day break. Senator John McCain will return to the Capitol after undergoing treatment for brain cancer in Arizona. Also today, we're going to get an announcement at the Department of Justice about DACA. Dreamers, President Trump has apparently decided to end that program, and the Attorney General will make that announcement at 10 o'clock this morning, Chicago time. NASA and the Smithsonian National Air and Space Museum celebrate 40 years of Voyager 1 and 2. Those spacecraft, humanity's farthest and longest-lived missions, now out in the outer solar system as they continue on. Also this morning, NAFTA talks continue, and Hewlett-Packard will report their quarterly results. Some of the things that could move the markets on this Tuesday, September 5th.